From the late 1800s to the 1950s, many African Americans, in order to live freely or simply have a job, shed their identities to pass as white. Our guest, Dr. Allison Hobbs, is an assistant professor at Stanford University and author of the book, A Chosen Exile, A History of Racial Passing in American Life. The stories of the people in her book demonstrate that those who passed for white also often gave up their communities, their culture, and their families. Allison Hobbs, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
What were the main reasons a person would choose to pass?
You said it so beautifully in the introduction that it was a range of reasons, that sometimes it was for employment, particularly during the Jim Crow era of segregation, where work was so much based on one's race, and that there were particular jobs, particularly more high-paying jobs, that were completely off-limits for Blacks and that were really exclusively held by whites. So there are many cases of Black doctors or Black lawyers who would graduate from law school or medical school and then could not find a job. So certainly economics would be a huge reason. Employment would be a huge reason. Being able to live in a better neighborhood would be another reason. And there were also just sort of kind of everyday simple dignities that I think people gained by being able to pass. So being able to be called Mr. or Mrs., which were respectful titles that only white women and white men were called, being able to have a better seat in a movie theater, not having to sit in the balcony, being able to have a more comfortable seat on a train, all of these smaller kind of everyday sort of experiences were often much improved when you were white rather than Black.
Well, one of the main themes in your book is loss.
Yes.
And I was drawn in by the story of Elsie Roxborough,
right,
who had a relationship of some kind with Langston Hughes.
Right.
Tell us what happened in her life.
She was born to a storied African-American family. She grew up during the Depression. And during the Depression, she and her family lived a life that few Americans, white or Black, could imagine. Elsie rode horses. The family had maids and chauffeurs. Elsie drove her father's cars, which was very unusual for a woman during that period, not, you know, much less for a Black woman. And they also vacationed at this very elite Black resort in Western Michigan called Idlewild. So she was really a part of the Black elite. But she was, I guess, unhappy. There was something missing from her life. And I think she felt that by passing as white, that would fulfill something for her. So she goes to the University of Michigan. She's actually the first Black woman to live in a dorm at the University of Michigan. She graduates in 1937. And while she's at Michigan, she is admired by Black and white men. Langston Hughes was one of her biggest fans. Her classmate, who would become the future playwright Arthur Miller, thought that she was just absolutely stunning. He called her the classiest girl in Ann Arbor. And she certainly got a lot of attention for her beauty and her elegance. And after she graduated, she decided that she was going to move to California and try to pass as white and also as a model and work as a model and as a screenwriter. That was her interest. So she moves to California. Things don't go quite as planned there. She decides to come to New York. Once she arrives in New York, she changes her name. So she leaves behind the famous Roxborough name, and she calls herself Mona Manet. She dyes her brown hair a kind of Titian red, so she's got this beautiful red hair. And she really was just an absolutely stunning woman. I mean, when you see pictures of her, she's just really, really striking. and she passes as white in New York. And the real tragedy of the story is that she still doesn't seem to find happiness, even as she's passing as white. So she's passing as white, and this causes a lot of controversy and a lot of disgust back in Michigan, where her family is. So as I was doing the research for this, I was very fascinated to read that it wasn't a secret that she was passing. So on the pages of the Michigan Chronicle, which was a black newspaper in Detroit, there were stories about how Elsie Roxborough was passing as a Nordic in Gotham and how the family was kind of embarrassed by this.
Well, you had a distant cousin who you learned passed as white. And I understand she was the impetus for your research on this book. This is not something your family spoke of regularly, and it sounds like this wasn't, it was the opposite kind of situation. Can you tell us her story?
Sure, yes. So when I was in graduate school, my aunt told me this story, which became the inspiration for this project. And it was exactly as you've said, it was about a distant cousin of ours who grew up in the 1930s, so around the same time as Elsie Roxborough. She lived on the south side of Chicago in a predominantly African-American neighborhood. She went to a predominantly African-American high school. She had mostly black friends. I mean, she lived the life of any sort of black child of her time. But when she graduated from high school, her mother told her that she wanted her to leave the South Side and to move to Los Angeles and to pass as white. And our cousin absolutely did not want to do this. She didn't want to leave her family behind. She didn't want to leave the only place and the only friends that she had ever known and her family. But her mother was determined, and her mother really felt that this was the very best thing that she could do for her daughter. Her mother felt that this was a way of increasing her daughter's life chances and opening more doors for her and giving her more opportunities. So she does go to California. She marries a white man. She has white children who know nothing about their mother's past. And years later, she receives a telephone call that is very inconvenient and very upsetting from her mother. And her mother is calling to tell her that her father is dying and that she must come home immediately. But despite these very dire circumstances, she never goes back to Chicago. And she essentially tells her mother, I can't go back. You know, I'm a white woman now. There's no turning back. And kind of tragically, this is kind of the circumstances and the conditions that her mother perhaps unwittingly created for her. You know, that by sending her to Los Angeles to pass as a white woman, and by that being exactly what she did, there would be these constraints and these limitations on her life. And one of them was that she couldn't go back. How would she explain that to her children? How would she explain that to her husband? She had likely told them that her family was dead, that she didn't have relatives, or she was an only child, or she had most likely made up some kind of story that would allow her to start this new life as a white woman. So how would she explain why she was going to the South Side of Chicago, which at that time, you know, and to this day really is known as being, you know, a kind of historic black neighborhood? So that story really kind of struck me and sort of haunted me, really. And it was the inspiration for my book, because it made me realize that while we think about passing as being very individualistic, it's also very social, and it includes so many more people and affects so many more people than I think we automatically assume. So, you know, obviously this affected her mother, this affected her father, it affected her brothers. I mean, the fact that when she hung up the phone, we can only imagine how she must have felt, knowing that she would never see her father again. She'd likely never see her mother, her brothers again. And just thinking about what that must have meant for her and that she couldn't even share that loss with anyone.
Right. She had to keep it completely to herself.
Right.
Well, thinking on the other kind of completely flipping this whole thing on its head and the media frenzy this year about Rachel Dolezal, who grew up white but identifies as black, ultimately running a chapter of the NAACP. And she angered people of all colors. But now that she's out, what do you think her chances are of recovering as a white person in the 21st century versus if one of the people in your book were found out?
It's so fascinating. I really have a lot of sympathy for Rachel Dolezal, and I was somewhat surprised at how much criticism she received. And I think partly it certainly is understandable why people would be angered by what she did. I mean, there's a lot of pieces of the story that are not very admirable, I guess, you know, that she, of course, had to lie on some applications. There's some questions about whether she took a scholarship when she was a student at Howard that would have been earmarked for a black student. There's a lot of questions about some of the decisions that she made. And I think that there's also a lot of anger about the fact that she was speaking for black people, and this sense that it's wonderful for there to be white allies to Black Lives Matter or to black causes, but to actually take that additional step and speak on behalf of black people as a black person was part of what really angered people about her. And while I absolutely understand all of those criticisms, I felt that she was doing something a little bit different. I don't feel like she was doing a kind of cultural appropriation in the very, very negative sense that we often associate, that we often think about when we think about cultural appropriation. So it's most common when it comes to music. And there's been, you know, so much resentment and you know, certainly very understandably, there's been a lot of anger about white musicians who have taken music from black musicians, and the white musician becomes very famous and very wealthy and the black musician does not. But in Rachel Dolezal's case, I don't think that that's what she was after. I think that she really believed herself and identified as black. And I certainly got a lot of criticism for saying that, but I still believe that. I mean, I think that one thing that people said was that, well, she still has white privilege. At any time, she could decide that she's going to stop going to the tanning salons and she's going to change her hair and she can always go back and live as a white woman. And that's absolutely true. And that is a very clear marker of white privilege, that you can sort of float in and out of identities as you wish, or some people can float in and out of identities as they wish. But I don't think that that's what Rachel Dolezal was interested in doing. I mean, I don't think that she has plans to return to a life as a white woman and return to her family in Montana. Certainly, she's quite estranged from them. So I just feel that she's a case of someone with a very complex identity, someone who we don't know all of the details of her family history. We don't know exactly what the circumstances were that led her to adopt her brother, actually. So she has a child of her own, and then she adopted her brother, who was adopted by her parents. So she had an adopted black brother and she adopted him. So we don't know all of the circumstances that led to that. And I just think that her story has a lot more complexity to it than maybe what we've kind of talked about. and that maybe there's more behind why she felt more comfortable or why she really saw herself as a Black woman.
Thinking about the context of history and the race relations conversations that are happening quite adamantly in the media, what can we learn from history that would help evolve race relations where they stand today?
Yes.
Big question.
No, that's a it's a great question. And that actually, I think, goes back very nicely to Rachel Dolezal, in a sense. I wrote an editorial for the New York Times, and one of the ways that I concluded it was by saying, you know, how might our society look different if there were more white people who really felt a kinship with someone like Eric Garner or Rekia Boyd or Tamir Rice or Sandra Bland or Trayvon Martin or, I mean, you know, I could go on, Freddie Gray. I mean, I could go on and on very tragically. So I guess that's part of the reason why I have a difficult time really attacking Rachel Dolezal, because it seems like here she is, she's the president of the NAACP chapter in Spokane. Everyone in that chapter loved her, and or at least as it was reported, everyone there said that she had done an incredible job, that she had really revitalized the chapter, and that the chapter was doing a lot of great work, that they were very involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. I don't know if we can say that all of that is for naught or all of that is now ruined by the fact that she wasn't actually Black. I agree with the idea of the importance of having white allies and the long history of white activists being very involved in Black causes, starting with NAACP, which was founded by a number of white activists and Black activists as well. But so the NAACP has a long history of having kind of interracial collaboration. But it just seems that what's missing in our society today is more of that deep understanding of the lives of others. And I think what was so fascinating to me about the interview with Hillary Clinton and the Black Lives Matter activists was that there was this one question where one of the activists asked Hillary Clinton, what has changed in her heart?
Mm-hmm.
You know, at first her campaign staffer interrupts. So here, this very poignant question has been asked. It's kind of interrupted. And then Hillary starts to talk about how you can't change hearts and that the Black Lives Matter movement needs to sort of come up with policies and then, you know, talk to politicians about policies.
Right. You have to change policies and change laws to change behavior is
right.
In effect what she was saying. Well, that's kind of the heart of my question is this, you know, historically, the laws have been about drawing these hard lines, whether it's segregation or desegregation, whether it's, you know, even where the voting lines are drawn or the Voting Rights Act and all of these things around this is Black and this is white,
right,
as opposed to how do we start crossing those lines in ways that are more beneficial.
Right.
While still acknowledging and recognizing what makes us all different.
Exactly. And that's what I thought was so interesting about the question that the activist from Black Lives Matter asked, because it almost felt like he was saying, just on a very personal level, what's in your heart? Can you watch the video of Tamir Rice, you know, a child being shot, and can you feel that that could have been your child. Or when you watch that, because Tamir Rice is a Black child, do you automatically feel a kind of distance from him and then see that whole tragedy unfolding in a very different way? And I think that that's really the way that we can move forward, is when someone of any race or any background can watch a tragedy and can really feel it as though it's happening to them or to their family, someone in their family. And I think that that's what that the activist was trying to get at, that there's of course we need to work on policies and laws and structural changes, absolutely, but we also do need to work on hearts. You know, we do need to work on the way people perceive things and the way people feel about things, and that maybe we haven't focused on that enough, because there's a role for that. And I think particularly when it comes to police violence, when it comes to, you know, I mean, we could go back to Katrina and the ways that the Katrina, the citizens of New Orleans were treated during Katrina, where, you know, there were these images of people trying to survive, you know, and the way that they were perceived if they were Black versus how they were perceived if they were white, and what a difference that would probably make in our policies if we saw both groups as trying to survive and trying to help their families and trying to make it through this horrible tragedy.
Well, in your position at Stanford, where you're constantly looking at history in the past, but history is unfolding right here before us, it must give you a very interesting perspective on what is happening. What is the best advice that you've ever received about either researching history or watching history unfold in the way that you can make sense of it?
You know, I think there's so many ways that we can understand so many things better by having a historical background. I mean, you know, how might the war in Iraq have been different if there had been more historians explaining the history of Iraq? Or how might our understanding of police violence be different if there was more understanding of the history of lynching? And, you know, there's so many connections, I mean, kind of startling connections between, you know, even something like Stop and Frisk in New York and in other places, and some of the Black codes that were instituted after the Civil War. So there's so many very clear connections and linkages between what's happening today and what happened in the past. And it feels almost like the past is just pregnant with possibilities and with a desire to educate us and to help us to make better decisions and to help us to think through problems with more complexity and more knowledge. And sometimes we don't always listen to it. But I think that it's absolutely critical, and I try my best, and I'm very thankful to my students for their enthusiasm and for their deep interest in wanting to make those kinds of connections and in wanting to look at, you know, well, how to look at the past to understand, okay, now I kind of understand a little bit better police brutality or the role of the state, or, you know, why Black women are marginalized, or why there's been, you know, issues about leadership and why it's so important, and why Black Lives Matter is so revolutionary in the sense that there really are a lot of Black women who are in, you know, high profile positions within Black Lives Matter. I mean, it was founded by three Black women. So all of those issues have kind of antecedents that it's really important that people know about.
Allison Hobbs, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
That was Allison Hobbs, professor of history at Stanford, whose book, A Chosen Exile, is coming out in paperback this spring. That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, listen to previous shows and sign up for our email updates. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio. And follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco, distributed by PRX, and you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller. Thanks for listening. You look pensive. Do you need a minute?